And we're holding on page 44 in Bava Metzia, the top of the page, middle of Ois Tes. The subject of the perek has been a pikodin and a shomer's responsibility for it. So the Mishnah says, the last Mishnah of the perek, Achoshev l'shloyach yad b'pikodin. If a person thinks that he, now earlier in the perek, it discusses the concept of shlichus yad. We have like this, you have the four kinds of shomerim. Each of them has varying degrees of responsibility for the thing. Let's talk particularly about shomer chinam and a shomer sachar who don't have the right to use the thing. The shomer sachar is watching it for free. The shomer sachar is being paid for it. Neither of them has any reshus to use the thing, with the exception of, in the previous perek, I talked about, you can have a case where the owner went off to Medina Sayyam and you have to use the thing every so often to keep it from getting rusty or moldy or whatever, but other than that, you have no business using it. So now you have something called shlichus yad, where the pasuk says imlo shalach yadeh b'malach asreihu, that in certain cases you have to take, if something happens to the thing, it gets lost or stolen or what have you, he has to take a shavua that he did not do shlichus yad, because if he did shlichus yad, if he stretched out his hand to take the thing and use it for himself, then he becomes chayav for anything that happens to it, even onus. So now the Mishnah says achoshev l'shleich yad b'pikodin. So if he thinks to do shlichus yad on the pikodin, now what do we mean by thinking? It can't just mean that he's thinking in his head on the face of it, because how would anybody know? So Rashi explains that it means that he actually said in front of Edim, I plan to take this pikodin and keep it for myself. Tosfos also explains that since the Gemara is going to learn it from the words I'll call Dvar Pesha, that implies that there has to be speech involved. Tosfos also, by the way, mentions in this connection here, for example, now in Daf Hayomi, the last two months plus, we've been learning Masechta Zvachim, and a large part of that deals with Machshavas that pass a carbon. They are also, Tosfos holds here and in other places, that it means the same thing. When we talk about a person as a Machshava that will pass a carbon, it really means that he speaks it out verbally. That said, not everybody agrees to that by a korban, and in particular, the Mishnah Lamelech understands the Rambam to be saying by korbanus that thought is enough. Whether it would be enough over here, thought is enough. Rashi and Tosfos at least are saying that not. Actually, elsewhere, Rashi himself does say elsewhere, it's Yosef Rings, l'chayev al-machshava oy al-adibur, implying that even a thought might be enough. But this is according to Beis Shammai that we're going to talk about. Beis Shammai imim chayev. So Beis Shammai says right away he'll be chayev in any onsin that happened to it, as if he had actually done the shlichus yad. One time, you find in the early years, one time there were Jungalite from a yeshiva called Oil Moshe that came to a yechidus by the Rebbe and asked a bunch of questions in what they were learning. And one of them was the question, if shlichus yad, in order to be kona something, you need to pick it up or you need to do something. How is it that the shamai can say that it's enough that he has a thought or to verbalize it or whatever, and that's enough for him to be chayev? And the answer was basically because as a shomer, he has a greater degree of responsibility. So therefore, once he says, according to Beis Shammai, that he plans to not be a shomer anymore, then he's putting himself relative to the thing in a new situation, and therefore he's chayev. Or Basilil Amin, ain't chayev at Yishlach Boyad. Basilil says he's only going to be chayev only if he actually stretches his hand against it, only if he actually misuses it. Shenema, because the pasuk says, Imay Shalach Yodib in Lachas Yael. But the pasuk says he has to swear that he did not do Shlichus Yad in what belongs to his fellow Yid, implying that he actually has to do it, just thinking is not enough. There's a sikha in Chelek Vav where the Rebbe talks about various times when we see that Beis Shammai tends to go more according to Bekoyach and there's still a more Bepoil. A famous example of it is Neiras Chanukah, where Beis Shammai says you have to go according to the number of days of Chanukah that are yet to come. Therefore, you start with 8 and work your way down to 1, whereas Basilah says you go according to Bepoil. Right now, Bepoil, we have 1 night, we have 2 nights, etc., and therefore we go up. So here, in a similar vein, Beis Shammai is going according to Bekoyach. He plans to do shlichus yad, and therefore that can be considered already as though he did it, whereas Basilah says there has to be bepoil mamish that he actually does it. This piece, by the way, was not part of the original Ein Yaakov. The original Ein Yaakov was meant to be of scope to include things of Agadta. It generally didn't include things of halacha. This Mishnah and the Gemara on it is straight halacha. So there's a pirush which is printed at the bottom of the page here called from Habboina. The author was Rabbi Huda Arya of Modena. He was a rav in the city of Modena in Italy, and he published an edition of Ein Yaakov with a lot of additions, including this. So he writes in his note over here, he explains that we can at least learn from this, given that the halacha is like the Basilah, we can learn from this that the same way as Bezalel is saying he's not going to be chayev just for thinking or saying that he's going to do the thing only for actually doing it, the same way the Eibishter does us a chesed, as we've learned before, machshava ra, ein hakadosh baruch hu mitzayev for the ma'aser, a person has bad thoughts, but Hashem doesn't count it against him unless he actually does it, the same way as we're saying over here. Now, it is true, he goes on to say, there is the concept, hirhura avera, koshim avera. The Gemara does say that thinking thoughts of avera in a way is worse than doing the actual avera itself. But that would mean when he actually thinks about it, when he actually delves into it with his mind, then he's being over, because that's more likely to lead him to action. But nevertheless, the Eibishter doesn't hold it so much against him, just the machshava, unless he actually is doing that machshava in a way that's going to that's going to actually lead to some kind of action. There is also a sicha from the early years where the Rebbe pointed out another lesson we can learn from this. The Torah is a pikodin by a yid. The Eibishter gives us the Torah as a pikodin for us to guard it and to learn it. So if a person is choshev l'shloach yod in Torah, would mean that he's learning the Torah, having in mind that he's going to use it for his own purposes. He's going to use it to become known as a big Talmud Chacham, to be famous, and so on and so forth. So we're saying that, So to that extent, there's a certain shlichus yad over there. And therefore, so a person can't do that. A person has to be learning Torah l'shma and not be thinking to take Hashem's pikadon and misuse it. Okay, so the Gemara says, minohani mili, where do we know this from? That, according to why is this Shammai saying that a machshava or dibur, as the case may be, is enough for him to be chayev? To turn rabbanon, we learn in a braisa. The posik says, I'll call dvar pesha. For all dvar of deliberate misuse, of deliberate carelessness. So devar means a matter of, but it also means a word. So Beshamai says that from that word, I'll call devar pesha, we learn that there doesn't have to be an actual maisa pesha, a devar, a word of it, a word in his mind, or at least a word in his mouth, is enough to is enough to make him chayev. And again, the Sibyl says, as it said in the Mishnah, he's only when chayev, only if he actually does shlichus yad, shenema, because the pasuk continues, im lo shalach yod b'melachas re'ehu, that he swears that he did not do shlichus yad against what belongs to his fellow yid, implying that we're talking about that he did actual shlichus yad and not just that he thought about it. So Beshamai says to Beshila, well, the fact is, it does say, I'll call Dvar Pesha. How can you ignore that pasuk? So Beshila answers back, yeah, but since the pasuk clearly says, so it's clear that there has to be actual shlichus yad, and just verbalizing it, just Dvar, is not enough. Im kain matam alayma akol dvar pesha. So says Vesila, what do we learn from the word dvar? Is like this. Sheyochol ain't the elahu. Because without the word dvar pesha, you would think only if he himself does shlichus yad, then he becomes chayev for anything that happens to pikadin. Omer la'avdeh l'shluchim inayin. How do we know if he told his servant or his shliach that he should go and misuse the thing? How do we know that he's also equally well chayev? Talmud lema, I'll call dvar pesha. That is why he uses the word dvar, that he speaks the word of pesha. He speaks to the other person and tells him, go do the shlichus yad. Now, usually we have a rule in halacha called ein shliach l'dvar avera. If Reuven tells Shimon to do an Avera and Shimon goes and does it, Shimon generally is the one who's responsible. But there are certain exceptions to that, and one of them is this case of Shlichus Yad. So Reuven, the Shomer, tells a servant or his Shliach Shimon to go do Shlichus Yad, Reuven will be the one responsible, and now he's going to be chayiv in any oinsin that happened to the thing. So the Bissel says that's what we learn from the word Dvar Pesha. Hazohav Perek Ravi, the Perek as a whole deals with dinim of Mekach or Memker, buying and selling. The beginning of the Perek deals with the concept that, it was a few days ago in Shlosha Parakim of Rambam, that the way to accomplish a kinyan on the Metalflin is not by giving money for them, but rather by doing some form of kinyan, such as Meshicha. So the Mishnah describes, it starts by saying Azahav, because it starts by talking about where, for example, you're trading one kind of coins for another. So one kind relative to the other will be considered payrus, based on various considerations that the Gemara talks about. The other one will be considered the money, and therefore, so when you do Meshicha on the payrus, then automatically the other one acquires the money, but not the other way around. Now, so the mission of these scribes in a similar vein. Moshe Chaimenu Peres, if Reuven does Meshicha of produce that he's buying from Shimon, V'loy Nosam Loy Mois, but he didn't yet give him money, Eini Yochel Lachzavo, he's not allowed to change his mind. Neither one of them can back out of the deal at this point because Meshicha was done and that constitutes a kinyan. Nosam Loy V'loy Moshe Chaimenu Peres, but if he gave him the money and did not yet do the Meshicha, Yochalachzaboy, then he can still change his mind because money does not actually create a kinyan. There is actually a machloikus about that in the Gemara, whether that is Rish Lakish holds that that's on a Daraisa level. Rabbi Yochanan holds that actually Daraisa money would accomplish a kinyan, and only Midirabbanan, the Chacham made a takana not to, because then imagine, for example, you could buy let's say a whole storehouse full of wheat, and you're not actually going and taking possession of it right now. You're saying basically, you know, I'm buying it from you now, it'll belong to me, but I'm leaving it in your storehouse until at some later date I'll send a truck to pick it up. Meanwhile, what happens, let's say a fire breaks out or something like that, the seller at this point has no incentive to try and save it. It's not mine anyway. So therefore, so the Chachamim instead made a takana that until he does Meshicha or some other valid form of kinyan, then it won't actually belong to him. So at that point, based on that takana, then just giving the money does not accomplish the kinyan. There's actually the Tzemach Tzedek has an explanation in Derech Mitzvei Secha about it in the mitzvah Mekach Omemker, he explains a deeper meaning behind this. The silver in particular, silver kesef represents it's a meloshen yearning. So that represents the koyach that's given milamayla. Meshicha represents where we have to take things from our possession. We have to take things from the gashmiyistic world and make Hashem the owner of them. Kone shamayim v'aretz. So we have to be moshech. We have to draw them out from olam hazeh gashmi and bring them into elokus. So what we're saying is, if there's meshicha, then automatically there will be kesef. Because once the person does his avoda down here, automatically the Eibishter will reciprocate. But not always the other way around, because the Eibishter can send down the kesef, but not necessarily will there be Meshicha as a result of that. And therefore it's not koina, that doesn't yet transform something of this world into Kedusha. The Tzemach Tzedek goes on to point out over there, That the Gemara explains that when it comes to a goy, the davka has to be meshicha. When it comes to a yid, again, you have this machlokas, Rav Yechanan and Rish Lakish, where the kesef will work on a daraisa level. So according to Rav Yechanan, we can say on a daraisa level, yes, we could say the original idea was that Hashem gives down the hashpa, and automatically that itself will elevate the world, but later on they had to make a takana differently. But by a goy, that never worked in the first place, because the Tzemach Tzedek explains, a goy is sholosh klipas atmeis. You want to get something out of his Rishus and into the Rishus of Eivishter, you definitely need Meshicha, no question about it. Fine. Aval Amru, but the Mishnah continues, however the Chachamim said, even though that is the din, that after the money has changed hands, either one of them can back out of the deal, but the Chachamim said, Misha Pora Me'anshe Dur HaMabel, Hashem who punished the people of the Dur HaMabel, or Me'anshe Dur HaFloga, and the people of the Dur HaFloga who built the tower above all, and the people of Sodom v'Amora, and then Hashem punished the Mitzriim by the Yamsuf, who also the Pora, Minisha on Omid B'Dibore. Hashem in the future will punish somebody who does not stick to his word. So he gave money and was all ready to do the deal, and then he backs out of it. So we say that Hashem will punish him just like he punished those groups. Why are we mentioning Davka those groups? So there's a few explanations. Marsha explains that in general, these are all groups of goyim before Matan Torah. So goyim are like that. The pasuk says on the Mashapim Diber Shav V'Yaminam Yamin Shaker, that they habitually lie and they don't keep their promises, as opposed to Jewish people, as the pasuk says Sheiris Yisrael La Yasu Avlov La Yadabru Kozav. Jews by nature are truthful and honest. So therefore, Marsha is saying that's why we don't want to mention any of the cases where Jews have been punished, because the whole point is we're saying, as the Gemara is going to say, he's not acting the way a Jew should. There's a few other reasons that Mephoshim give why Dafka single out these. Habona at the bottom of the page points out that each one of them did something against the social order. The Dora Mabel, they were doing chomos, they were robbing and being violent towards one another. The Dora Flogger, they're trying to bring themselves all to one place and stay in one place and not spread out all over the world to form different societies as the world needs. The people of Sodom and Amora were preventing travelers from coming through. They didn't want any travelers coming through their place. And the Mitzrayim enslaved the entire Jewish people for nothing, without even having any excuse for it. The Pasuk, in fact, phrases that Pasuk is something else, but whatever. The point is that the Mitzrayim enslaved the Jewish people without even having a valid excuse for it. So each one of them did something against the social order, and so we're saying this person is also, by not keeping his word, he's also destroying society, and therefore Hashem will punish him in the same way. There's different other interesting explanations about what these four groups have in common. Then there's a sicha that Rebbe talked about in Tafshin Memtes in connection with the Rambam at the time. So the Rebbe talked about, again, here Marsha is saying that we're focusing specifically on Goyish nations, because again, we don't want to mention punishments of Jews. We want to focus, as Marsha is saying, on what the Goyim did, but the Rebbe took it in a different way. The lesson from it is, again, when we're saying, following this idea of the Tzemach Tzedek, that we're talking about, that the silver, the money, represents the Ashpa Milamayla, and the Meshicha represents the Avodah Milamata. Well then, what we're saying is, if a Yid has received the Ashpa Milamayla, but he's not reciprocating, he's not doing his Avodah and doing the Meshicha, then it means he's acting, so he's not acting the way a Yid should act. A Yid should have a natural desire to reciprocate what the Eibishter is doing. So we mentioned to him the Goyish nations, but why do we mention Davka them? The Rebbe explains, because only from the point of view of the Goyishkeit and the Gashmiest of the world is it even necessary for there to be a Mashiach in the first place. Really, from the point of view of a Yid alone, it shouldn't be necessary. It should have to be that the Eibishter is able to give us the Kesef, and that alone accomplishes everything. The fact that there has to be Avodim Lamata, that there has to be Avodim Sabirudim, is really because of what was done in the earlier generations of taking a Lakos out of the world, that was done by the Anshadur HaMabel and the Anshadur HaFloga and so forth, and therefore we tell him it's because of that you need to do your Mashicha, and therefore we're going to tell you Misha Parda in order to encourage you, don't be like them, be like a Yid should be. So the Gemara says, Itmar, Abaya Omar. So when we say, when the Mishnah is saying Misha Parda, is the Mishnah just telling us a fact, or is the Mishnah telling us something that we tell him? So Abaya Omar, doing made inanlay. Abaya says we inform a person who's doing this that we tell him, if you renege on this deal, then the Eibishter is going to punish you like he did those people. But we don't actually make an official curse of it in Beis Din. Rava Omar Melech Laitinanlay. Rava says we actually officially curse him in Beis Din, and Beis Din says before he's going to back out of the deal, if you back out, then here we're putting an official curse on you. Mi Shapara, Me Anche Dora Mabel, etc., etc., Hu Yipara, and then now if you want to back out of the deal, then go ahead. Abaya Omar Duim Inanlay. Abaya says we should only inform him and not actually place a curse on him. Because the Pasuk says, a Nasi among your people, you should not curse. And we learn from that more generally that you're not allowed to curse a fellow Yid. So why should Beis Din curse the guy unnecessarily? Rava Amar, Melech Laitinanlay, Rava says they could actually curse him, Dichtiv Ba'amcha, because the Pasuk says, V'nasi Ba'amcha, from which we learn, Ba'oisin Ma'isa Amcha, only when he's acting the way a Yid should act, and here, by backing out of his deal, then he's not, as Marshal said, now he's acting like the Goyim, Mashapim Dibashav, so he can actually be cursed. Tosfos points out that it only means as far as this thing, doesn't mean that in general, now this Yid is misbehaving, you can go curse him on anything you want, it means in this specific area, where he's not behaving as a Yid, then you put on him this curse of Misha Parda. And again, in that sicha, the Rebbe explains that the idea is not so much to curse him, but in order to encourage him, realize that the whole reason there's a need for Avodah Sabirurim, for his Sarusah Delasata, is because of the mentality exemplified by the Anshei Dor HaMabel and Anshei Dor HaFloga and the rest of them. Really, from the point of view of a Yid, it shouldn't be necessary, but the fact is, right now, this is what's needed for us Jews, and you are not acting like a Jew, so shape up and behave like a Yid should, and keep your word. And that means, in other words, as far as your fellow Yid, but also as far as the Eibishter, and reciprocate what the Eibishter is giving you the Kesef, reciprocate with Mashicha and bringing the world into the Eibishter's Rishus. Okay. Further on, the Gemara talks about Itzmar, Dvarim. Now, this is so far we were talking about where actual money changed hands. So the Mishnah is saying, again, that even if Meshicha wasn't done yet, then there's no kinyan. Therefore, he could back out of the deal. However, he has to be willing to accept this curse of Misha Parah. But now, what if they just made a verbal agreement between them? And they didn't have, no money actually changed hands or anything. So now, can he back out? So Rav said there's no problem of being of not being faithful to his word. By doing that, he can back out of the deal. Rav Yechanan says there still is an issue of mechusra amana. There was a big machlokas we showed him on this, which eventually makes it into Shulchan Aruch and the Noisa Kalim. Are we talking about even, let's say, he has a valid reason? What if, for example, the price has changed, the price has gone up or down, and therefore one of them wants to back out because now the deal is not advantageous to him anymore? Is Rav saying only in that case is it not mechusra amana? And Rav Yechanan is saying still that's a lack of faithfulness to do that. Or are we talking about even when there's no good reason, there's no particular reason for him to back out at all? It just feels like backing out, and Rav is saying there's no problem, and Rabbi Yochanan is saying that there was a problem then, but if there was a valid reason, maybe Rabbi Yochanan would agree that it's fine. So they're showing him disagree about that. So the Gemara says, Mesi. So I have a contradiction then. So you're telling me, according to Rav, that there's no problem, backing out of the deal, at least under some circumstances. It's not even considered mechusar amana, it's not considered a lack of faithfulness. The question is, Rav Yosi, Rav Yehuda Omer, Ma Tamad Lama Hin Sedek. Now, the Torah tells us you have to have honest weights and measures. The expression in the Pasuk is that you have to have Eifas Sedek V'Hin Sedek. So in the simple meaning, it means you have to have an honest Eifa and an honest Hin. But the question is, why does it need to say Hin Sedek? V'Ala Hin B'Chal Eifa Hu Ohoya. A hin is included in an Eifa. Because Rashi explains, a hin consists of 12 log. An Eifa is much larger. An Eifa is 3 saw, which is 72 log, because there are the conversion factors. You know, it's a lot easier when you use, you know, you have nowadays you have a metric system, which all works by powers of 10, which is fairly easy to understand the relationships. In the American system, we use the little more complicated, but still, the one they used back then was even more complicated. You had 4 log to the kav, 3 kav to the saw, and 3 saw to the Eifa. So altogether, then it comes out 72 log to the Eifa, whereas a hin is 1/6 of that, 12 log. So once the Torah tells us you have to have an honest Eifa, of course you have to have an honest hin. Why bother mentioning it? Moshe points out the fact is, it is true that a hin is a liquid measure and an Eifa is a dry measure, but still, there's no particular reason to think that there should be a distinction between them. Ella, loy malach. So it comes to tell you, we douse in the word hin as though it was the word hain, which means yes. The lav shaloch tzedek. It means that your yes should be an honest yes, and your no should be an honest no. So therefore, so we see from that that yes, a person is a yid is supposed to keep his word. So why is Rav saying that he can back out of the deal when there's no money changed hand and there's no problem and no problem and it's not even considered mechusar amana? Where do we get the no over here? So Yom Yaakov says, listen, you know, if we're saying that the yes has to be a yes, then obviously the no has to be a no, and he explains another reason why we can learn it from the Pasuk. The Rif over here says another reason. We can douse in the word Eifa as well, as if it said E pe. E means is a word in Aramaic, and is a word in Aramaic, and rarely in Lashon Kodesh, that means not. And pe means the mouth. So not with the mouth. So your not with your mouth also has to be an honest not. So how can Rav say that there's not a problem for him to back out of the deal? Somebody says that's not what the Pasuk is talking about. That's saying that a person shouldn't speak hypocritically. You shouldn't be saying when you're speaking a yes, it should be, in other words, when you're saying yes, don't plan to change it. But here, for example, the price changed, or according to the Rishonim, who say it doesn't matter whether the price changed, you have some other reason you want to back out, then fine, gizum to hate, it's not a pesona namona. However, the Gemara says, Maisi, they'll have another contradiction. Reb Shimon Omer, that Reb Shimon expands on what it said in the Mishnah about Misha Parah, Afal Pisha Omru Talis Koina Dinner Zahav, then Dinner Zahav Koina Talis, even though the Chacham explained to us that a Talis acquires the gold dinner, meaning that, like we said before, if a person is going to buy a talis for a gold dinner, it's not the giving the gold dinner that now requires the other person to give him the talis, it's the other way around. Once you do Mashiach on the talis, then you are obligated to give the other guy the gold dinner. the Indian is of Kona Talis. It's not the other way around. If you gave him the gold dinner, he's then he's not yet fully required to give you the talis, because at that point he can back out of the deal and say that I want to sell the talis to somebody else. Mekomo kam ka halacha. Reb Shimon says that is the halacha. It is true that money does not constitute a kinyan. Only Meshicha does. Again, according to Reb Shlokish Daraisa and according to Reb Yochanan, because of a takanas chachamim. Abel omru, however, the chachamim said, me, as we said in the Mishnah, Misha Potam, Ancha Dura Mabel, Ancha Dura Floga, Hashem will punish the people of the Mabel or the people of Dura Floga and the rest of the groups that we mentioned over there, who also be part of Mishnah and Bidibura, then Hashem will punish somebody who doesn't keep his word. So we're saying, now Rashi explains that the Mishnah goes, the Braisa that we're quoting over here goes on to say that if a person backs out of a deal, Ein Ruach Chachamim Noichahemenu, the Chachamim are not pleased with such a person. So in other words, you have the technical case of Misha Pora, when money changed hands, but in addition, you also have that you can't back out of a deal, even when there was no money involved, because Ein Ruach Chachamim Noichahemenu, the Chachamim are not pleased with a person who does that. So how can Rav say there's no problem? And the answer is Tanoi. There's actually a Machloikas Tanoim about that, because, as we're going to quote now from a Mishnah, that Rabbi Yochanan and Ben Maskia disagrees, well, very well, Rav is entitled to follow that opinion. Namely, Zitanan. We learn later on in the Masechta, at the beginning of the seventh Perek, the Mishnah starts by saying over there that when you hire workers, it's generally a kol minig hamedina, and that includes that if minig hamedina is to feed them, is to provide them lunch on the job, then you have to do that. So the Mishnah says, whatever the minig hamedina is, as far as what you supply them for lunch, is what you have to supply them. So the Mishnah says, Maisib Rabbi Yochanan Masya, Sha'om Lubnoit, Seyu Scholan Apoyalim. It happened once that Rabbi Yochanan ben Masya told his son, go hire us some workers. So the son went and found workers, and he told them that he specifically told them that we're going to give you meals on the job. When the son came back to his father, Rabbi Yochanan, Omale, he says, no, you shouldn't have said that. Bni, afilo ata oislam kisudas shloima b'shaitei. Even if you would have, now that you committed that you're going to give them meals, even if you were to make them a suda as big as Shloima used to make during his good times, during the years when he was the undisputed king, when he was not involved with Ashmedai and all that, and the Pasuk describes in Malachim the tremendous feasts that would be made every day. We're going to learn about it later on in our Masechta, week or two, Bez Hashem. So even if you were to give them kesudas shloima b'shaita, like the sudas of shloima that he did in his times, lo yatzasi yedei chivas chaimam, you still wouldn't actually be fulfilling your obligation to them, shem b'nei Avraham Yitzchak v'Yaakov, because they're children of Avraham Yitzchak v'Yaakov, and they deserve even more than that. The Gemara goes on to explain later on that we find that proportionately per person, what Avraham offered the three malachim is more than what Shlomo offered his guests. As much as the Pasuk describes the hundreds and thousands of animals that they had every day for Shlomo's banquets, but when you consider the number of people that were there versus when you consider Avraham's three calves for three guests, it comes out that Avraham gave his guests more than Shlomo gave his. So therefore, so Rabbi Yochanan ben Masya says, based on that then, every yid being b'nei Avraham Yitzchak v'Yaakov deserves more than Shlomo gave his guests. So no matter how much you give them, it wouldn't be enough. Ella, so rather, he tells his son, actually a skill of a malacha, before these workers actually start working, because once they started working on the understanding, so in other words, in short, he's telling his son, you told them you're going to give them a meal, and therefore I could be on the hook for any large meal. So actually a skill of a malacha, so he tells them rather, before they start the actual work, Seva Emelahem, go out and tell those workers, I'm hiring you, and only on condition that the food I'm required to supply you is only bread and beans. Later on in the Masechta, by the way, when the Gemara brings, so again, this is at the beginning of the seventh parak, the Gemara brings over there that the Gemara brings this piece, and the Gemara asks, what is the correct girsa? Is he promising to give them pas v'kitnis, bread and beans, or pas kitnis, bread made out of beans? And the Gemara explains it's very clearly pas v'kitnis, and the Gemara has an unusual expression over there. You have to have a levav as large as mudir de labrus, the rudder that they use to steer a ship on the Labrus River. The Gemara has, in other words, like the Vav definitely has to be there. There's a fascinating long piece from Levi Yitzchak, the Rebbe's father, that talks about the deeper meaning behind that and connects it with another another appearance of that expression in connection with the Vava Vaizosa. The Gemara mentions in Megillah the Vava Vaizosa, and the Megillah also has to be extra large, Kemurdia de la Brusa. And I believe it has a long, fascinating explanation, Api Kabbalah, of the connection between the two things and why it's so important to stress that it's past Vikitness. Because he explains the idea is because kitness represents katnus samochin and past bread represents gadlus samochin, and to say past kitness suggests that all you need is katnus samochin, and it's not so. You need both. So therefore you must have that vav in there, and why it's so important that that vav be as large as that. Anyway, the point is, the Gemara says v'isakudaitachus vorim yeshvam mishum mechusri amana. Now, how does that show that Rabbi Yochanan ben Masya holds that you're allowed to go back on your word and there's no problem? It's not a lack of amana, because if that was a problem, heichi omalei zil hoderbach, how could he tell his son go retract it? The son had promised them meals, which could mean even greater than kasudas shalom v'shaite, and now he's going to tell them just bread and beans. That's reneging on what he had committed to them, and yet Rabbi Yochanan ben Masya doesn't seem to have a problem with it. So you see, says the Gemara, that there is a Tana who holds that that's fine. So can be following that Tana. However, the Gemara says not necessarily. Shiny Hossam, because different in that case, because the workers themselves, when the son tells them, I'm going to give you meals, that my father is going to give you meals, they don't necessarily have a smichus das. They're not necessarily, it's determined in their head that this is how it's going to be. My time, or why? Maybe Yadi, Dalavur Samach. They know that he's relying on his father, and it's really going to be up to his father what he's going to supply them. So if the son was hiring workers for himself, then yes, we could assume that they meant, that they had in mind that it could be considered a shlem of a shaiter even more. But because it's the son doing it on behalf of his father, and they know the son is not the one who's actually going to be paying them, or is going to be responsible for their food or anything like that, so they themselves didn't really expect in the first place that what the son said is binding, and they therefore, now when the son tells them, you know what, I made a mistake, it wasn't like that, then for sure there's no problem with Chosri Amana. So there's not necessarily a proof from there that for Rav's opinion, and the Gemara continues to go on with the discussion of the matter. Eventually, the Gemara gets into a discussion, a related point. The Gemara tells a story involving somebody who had sold some sesame seeds, and the money was deposited by him as a pikadon, and then the money was stolen. And the question is, is he chayev bachrusa for the money? So then the Gemara says, there was one version of the story that the Gemara told. However, the Gemara says, Amar Papi, Amar Le Ravina, that Ravina told me that the version of the story as we had it before that in the Gemara is incorrect. That's not actually how it happened. A certain one of the Chachamim named Rav Tovus told me as follows. Some say that his name is Rav Shmuel Bar Zutra. Now this Rav Tovus, or Rav Shmuel Bar Zutra, you want to know how honest he was. If they were to give him all the treasures of the world, he would never tell a lie. So, and he tells us that this version of the story, as we had in the Gemara, and the halachas that we wanted to derive from it, is incorrect, and in fact, the story happened differently. So the Gemara doesn't, so in Yaakov here doesn't go into the details of that, but the point is we want to stress that there was this, that we have this person who we know is, so that we can describe him as so honest that he would never lie or change his words, even for all the treasures in the world. Habayna points out that the word chalala da'alma is an interesting one. Chalala literally means the hollow. So it means, in other words, like it can mean meloshin hollow, which can also mean meloshin cholol, which also means a dead body. So like all the treasures of the world to him are like just something empty or dead. He doesn't care the slightest for them. The most important thing for him is absolute truth. And the Maharal, in one of his sforim called Nesivas Olam, which is a sefer, he goes through the various midas tovus that a person has to have and explains and brings sources for them in Chazal. So he brings the why is he called Reb Tovus, representing, in other words, that he's the ultimate good, because he's the paragon of Emes, and therefore he's the ultimate good. In a different place, the Gemara calls him by a different name, Reb Tavyumi. What Tavyumi means, the Maharal explains, he has even more than that. He has the goodness of the light. So he's the ultimate degree of goodness, like the light, which is the first thing that the Eibishter called Toiv. Further on in the Perek, it talks about, now, like this. The second half of the Perek deals with Dinim of Oinah. You have Einas Momon and you have Einas Dvarim. So Einas Dvarim, we're going to have a large piece of Agada about. Einas Momon is, it was in Rambam recently, that you're not allowed to overcharge or underpay more than a certain percentage for an item. And if you do, you have different dinim when there's mechila, when we say that the sale is still a sale, but you're entitled to a refund of the difference, and when there's bitul metach, when you can cancel the sale altogether. So from the middle of the perek until from the middle of the paragraph almost to the end of it, it deals with all the details of them and all the ins and outs of those dinim. In the course of that, it also mentions now there can be a nar with coins as well. Back then, coins basically were valued based on the amount of metal in them. It wasn't like nowadays, for example, a dime doesn't have 10 cents worth of metal in it, but we accept it as a dime because the United States government says so. But back then it wasn't like that. You had a silver dinner, for example, you expected that it was going to have a dinner's worth of silver in it. So you have details over there where let's say you want to offer somebody a coin for merchandise, and the coin is a little bit underweight. So under what circumstances is it considered a valid transaction? In what case is it considered a nah, and you have to refund him the difference? And in what case is it a bitul mek? But basically the idea is similar to merchandise. The threshold is 1/6. So then the Mishnah goes on to say, suppose you have a coin that's a little underweight, then you can still use it for redeeming Maisa Sheni. Because if it's only a little underweight, then the Mishnah says that only a stingy person would refuse to accept it. Most people would accept such a coin and spend it as if it was a complete dinner, and therefore you're allowed to use it as a dinner to redeem Maisa Sheni. So that leads the Gemara into a long discussion stretching over a couple of blocks about various dinim of Pidyon Maisa Sheni and the dinim of Maisa Sheni in general. In the middle of it, the Gemara mentions the following piece. The Gemara presents a case where you have you have money that you can't redeem, that you can't do anything with. So the question is, so why? If it hasn't yet come to your shalayim, you can redeem it. The case is where it was brought into your shalayim and then taken out of your shalayim. So the Gemara asks, well, once it's outside of your shalayim again, why shouldn't you be able to redeem it? And the answer is because it became tamei. So the answer is, so what? If it became tamei, then you could redeem it even in your shalayim. And this is the piece over here. Omer Abelazer, minayma ma'isa sheni shenikma. How do we know if ma'isa sheni became tamei, shepoidin osaf for the bir shalayim, that you can redeem it even in your shalayim? If it's tahor, then you can't. You have to actually eat the ma'isa sheni itself in your shalayim. You wanted to redeem it, you should have done that outside your shalayim. But Abelazer is saying, if it became tamei, you can do it right there in your shalayim, shenemar. Because the pasuk says kilo suchal se'esoi. Because the pasuk says that when do you redeem my sheni? When you can't se'esoi. So the simple meaning of se'esoi is you can't carry it. You have a lot of my sheni and it's too much to transport to your shalayim. But we also understand that in se'es el achila, the word se'es can also mean to eat. As we find by Yaakov, when he had a banquet with his brothers right before the second time they came down to Mitzrayim with Binyamin, and they sat down to a whole feast together, and the pasuk says that he gave out masos from his presence to them, where masos means portions of food. So therefore, by the same token, kilo suchal se'esoi also means because you can't eat it. Now, why can't you eat it? Because ma'aser sheni became tameh, and ma'aser sheni can be eaten only b'tahara. So now, the pasuk is implying, therefore, that even then, you can redeem it, and here, there's no difference between in your shalayim and outside it, so you can redeem it, and then set by tahor food with it and eat it there. So that's the Gemara asks, in this case, when the food was taken into your shalayim and then taken out, why we can't be poyed at, and the Gemara goes on to discuss the exact details of the case, but we just have this little piece over here, seeing that kilo suchal se'esoi has another meaning as well. It means that you can't eat it because, not just you can't carry it to your shalayim, because too much, but also you can't eat it because it's tamei, and therefore that has implications as far as what you can do with it. Okay. Yom Yom Mashiach Ha'Gu'ola, Gimel Kislev. The Zohar tells us that the rainbow is one of the signs of the Ga'ola. Now, what is the rainbow? The Abba Benel explains that we're talking about a rainbow was a sign that there's not going to be a marble again. Why? Because the Abba Benel explains that represents that the world was more refined through the marble. Basically, he explains that why. There's a question basically comes down to, when Hashem is saying the rainbow is a sign that is a sign, What does that mean? Was there never a rainbow before? If there was, then how all of a sudden has it become a sign that there won't be a Mabul? So different Mefoshim have different takes on that. The Abravanel takes the view that in fact before the Mabul there were never any rainbows because basically the atmosphere was too thick to allow sunlight to pass through and refract and form a rainbow. So now that means, in other words, when the Eibishter is saying I'm going to make rainbows, means the air, means the atmosphere itself is more refined. So in other words, exactly that. Before the Mabul, the clouds were too thick and materialistic, and therefore the sunlight didn't refract through them. After the world is transformed and then refined by the Mabul, so the clouds are also more translucent, and therefore the sunlight can get through them, and that's how you have a rainbow. So therefore, so there's a connection then between the rainbow, and so the Zohar is saying that a rainbow is one of the simonim of the Gola. What does one have to do with the other? Now we understand, that Rebbe says, because in Mashiach's times, the world will be completely refined, and therefore, so if one degree of refinement made it possible to have a rainbow, then the ultimate refinement of Mashiach's times is also associated with the rainbow.
Actually has the rainbow itself. It's a good
thing. The bad things. So seeing the rainbow itself, right, it shows on the one hand that the Eibishter is angry with the world, and that's why in Rashbi's times there wasn't one. Yeah. There is that. But nevertheless, I mean, it also says the Shekhinah appears in the rainbow, which is why you're not supposed to gaze at it. Yeah, which is why you're not supposed to gaze at it. Yeah. We do have, the fact is, in Hayom Yom, you have the Pisgam, one of the days in the Cheshvan, that we do say Birchas HaKeshes, unlike those who question it, that Al Tadeva didn't include it in the Siddur. Nevertheless, we do say it when we see a rainbow. Okay. So we were talking about before the dinim, that if a person feels he has to go to the bathroom, then he has to go right away, and otherwise he's over on Bal Teshachtu, and we talked about when does that apply. Yes, I mean, it doesn't apply to Ketanim. If he's able to hold himself back for the time it takes to walk a parasa, which is anywhere between 72 and 92 minutes, 72 and 96 minutes according to the different poskim, then there's not a problem. Now, here the Alter Rebbe goes on. Yesh Oimim, this includes the Ramah, that even if he's not able to hold himself back for that amount of time, nevertheless, you have like this. A person has a need to go to the bathroom, and then they have a what's called Koyach HaDoicha, the force within them that's pushing it out. And then on the other hand, they have Koyach HaMachzik, the power that keeps it inside. So now, basically, the Alter Rebbe explains that if he's not needing it so badly, so you have like this. If he has to force himself to hold it in, if he has to force the Koyach HaMachzik to be stronger than Koyach HaDoicha, then that's no good. At that point, he has to go to the bathroom. But if it was, he doesn't really need to push out anything. It just comes out naturally. But if it's not quite so much, he actually has to push, meaning that the Koyach HaMachzik by itself is strong enough, then it's not called, according to the Ramah, then it's not called Masha Nekovav, then it's really a matter of Shev Val Tase. He's passively not going, and therefore it's not an issue of Val Teshachtu, according to the Ramah. So that would mean, even if he feels that sometime in the next 72 or 96 minutes he has to go to the bathroom, but right now, he's still able, without effort, to hold it in, then according to the Ramah, it's not a problem, whereas according to the other poskim, at that point he needs to go as soon as possible, subject, as we said before, to cover the abrius and other factors like that. Mm. Yeah. I don't know. Not even a